Meditation.
Depending on the quality of my mind.
You know, there's good days and bad days. And good days as well.
Feel like the waterfall of thoughts. And every now and then, a nice calm.
I can't think of anything.
This is Meditation in the City.
The Shambhala New York Podcast.
And I'm Dave, your host. Yeah. And today on the podcast, we have a newcomer to the podcast, Kevin Bogle. He is a newer teacher here at the Shambhala Meditation Center of New York. He is a landscape architect for the city of New York. And this was a talk he gave, making our podcast debut, a talk he gave at our weekly Dharma gathering just a couple of weeks ago about dealing with strong emotions. How do we get through everyday life and wrestle with these feelings that can sometimes just take us away from our meditative bliss, so to speak. So very happy to bring you this talk by Kevin Bogle. Visit our website, ny.shambhala.org, for all of our upcoming courses and weekend retreats, in particular, our introductory meditation course, which is called Meditation in Everyday Life. It's happening next, the four Thursdays in October, beginning October 5th, four Thursdays, Thursday evenings, Meditation in Everyday Life. It's a great introductory course to become acquainted with the meditation technique and with common obstacles, everything you need to do to set yourself up for a home meditation practice. Register on the website for that or anything else we have coming up. And now, Kevin Bogle. So these strong emotions, they happen to you?
You know, I could have like a really nice morning sit, get dressed for work, have a nice healthy breakfast, feel good. Then I go get on the train, and sometimes between stations, the train's going to stop due to an earlier incident, and who knows how long we're going to be there for. And boom, all that serenity and peace and tranquility I've been cultivating is just right out the window, and in comes anxiety about getting to work on time, fear that I'm going to be late to get to the meditation that I'm trying to get to. You know, these emotional experiences can come up out of nowhere and very quickly. And then we're just thrown off the wagon, off the horse. And it can be emotional experiences like fear or anger or anxiety. It can also be positive emotional experiences. We see someone, you know, we're on the way somewhere and we see someone across the park that catches our eye, and all of a sudden we're filled with, you know, love and desire and attraction for this person. And so I was thinking about the Dharma of everyday life, and I thought about, you know, maybe talking about working with these strong emotional experiences could be one way to help us all as we move forward, trying to bridge the gap between the cushion and the rest of our life. So it seems to me that there's, you know, three basic ways that we take the world in, that we can kind of locate ourselves in the world. There's our sense perceptions, you know, what we see and taste and smell and touch and hear, both externally, and then also we have internal sense perceptions, a sense of gravity, a sense of balance, aches and pains. So that's one, is the sense perceptions. The second way we locate ourselves in the world is through our thoughts, you know, the things we're working with in meditation, categorizing things, labeling things, figuring out how we're going to be and behave and act, and kind of the internal thought process. And then the third way is kind of the bridge between the two. It's our emotional experiences. It's when something out there mixes with our thoughts, and then we have this kind of new type of thing. It's not just a thought. So just to define some terms, when we're talking about emotions in the Buddhist context, in a Shambhala context, what we're talking about are thoughts with a lot of energy behind them. And when we're talking about mind, we're talking about something from a Buddhist perspective that is fundamentally clear, it's knowing, it's aware, it's pure, it's without blemish. It's a lot like, yeah, there's a piece of crystal, a crystal sphere on the shrine behind me. And it's kind of said that that represents our mind, that it's clear and unblemished, but it kind of takes on the colors of what's around it, right? So right now there's some orange behind it, so it looks orange. If we were to put that same piece of crystal in a white room, it would have a completely white appearance to it. And so our mind relates to emotions as if they were colors. So the emotional experiences we have color our thoughts. They color our mind. And emotions are thoughts with a lot of energy behind them. So contemporary science can tell us what emotions, what that energy is. What is the energy of emotions? Like I said, our senses can pick up on the outside world. And then there's also inner senses as well, called interoception. And this is the sense of, you know, what's going on in the body. What's tightening, what's contracting, what's releasing, where is there pain? What do we need to attend to in the body? So it's really actually fascinating to me the way emotions come up is through this interoceptive process that somewhere back in our lizard brain, in like the pre-verbal, pre-thinking part of our mind that we got through evolution, the emotions start. And they start by we perceive something in the world, and maybe we see it as a threat. And immediately, before we even come to the thought, oh shit, that's a threat, our body starts to respond in a way to prepare us. So the sheaths around our organs will tighten up to protect us, and adrenaline will course through our body to get us ready to run. And we'll have this complete physical response. And then the thought will come up, why am I feeling like this? Oh shit, something must be wrong. There's a garden hose, but I think it's a snake. And so I'm terrified. And then we can realize it's a garden hose and kind of calm down a little bit. But the important thing is that we have this physical response to the world and then come up with a story to explain why we feel the way that we're feeling. And the physical responses are pretty dull in a way. Like our eyes can be pretty clear seeing and we can hear with a lot of clarity. But our interoceptive sense is actually kind of stupid. It has four things that it can pick up on. Feeling of pleasant, a feeling of unpleasant, a feeling of arousal, and a feeling of calm. And that's it. And then from those four feelings, we create the stories that become our emotions. So that's just a little backstory into what's going on, what the process is. So typically we have two ways when we have an emotional experience that we're habituated to react. Through cultural conditioning, through the way our parents taught us, through the way we see our friends reacting, what we see on TV. So the first way is acting out on that emotion, and the second way is repressing. And so in acting out, really that's a pattern of feeling something in our body, then creating a storyline about that, and then doing something about it. So for example, we're in a meeting with our boss, and once again, they blame us for something being late. And so we immediately feel like we have to defend ourselves and come up with a story about, well, no, this isn't me, this is someone else. And you always get mad at me, and it's really not fair. And so I'm going to say something about this. And so you respond in a way to defend yourself in this situation. Or if anxiety is more of a flavor that you're used to, the story might be, oh, I'm about to lose my job, and then I won't have any money, and then I'll have to do a whole job search, and then my friends won't want to hang out anymore. And so the situation is that we kind of come up with these stories that spin us very quickly away from what's actually happening in the moment. You know, the person is saying something to us, that we're in a meeting, that there's something actually happening. Acting out can be creating a story and then we say or do something about it. Maybe we have a temper and we act out by yelling or slamming something. Or maybe we act out by crying and communicating in that way. Or it could also be an internal situation where You know, how many of us have had the thing where we think for hours how we should have responded to someone, and we kind of go over that conversation again and again, just like, I really should have said. Or preparing for the conversation we're about to have and planning out every last detail of how it's going to be. The funny thing is about our interoceptive system is that it can't distinguish between what's actually happening and what's just in our minds. When we're thinking angry thoughts, when we're thinking about saying something angrily, our body reacts in the same way. And I think this can be easily shown by, like, has anyone had a weird dream about someone where you, like, had a fight with someone in your dream and then woke up and felt really strange about them, or someone wronged you, and then when you saw them, you felt weird? Or, like, you kissed someone you shouldn't have kissed in your dream, and then that's, like, that was kind of weird? Like, our bodies can't quite tell. So regardless, what happens is we have an experience, we come up with a story, and in the acting out paradigm, we develop that story further. And then the problem is we have further sensations related to that that aren't actually grounded in what's happening in the moment. And so maybe we're tired of acting out, we're tired of kind of continuing this pattern of being. The other typical way that people react to strong emotions is, in my experience, through repression. And maybe it comes as a response of not wanting to act out anymore, or maybe you're culturally conditioned by folks around you growing up that you shouldn't show certain emotions. I think men are often taught that they shouldn't show sadness or weakness. You know, women, maybe anger isn't so okay to show. So repression is the idea that when these experiences come up, we don't acknowledge them at all. We pretend it's not there. We just, nope, put a lid on that. Doesn't exist. Push it down. And that doesn't work either. Firstly, it's being dishonest with ourselves and with other people about what's actually happening with us. But secondly, when we repress our emotions, they often will either transform into another emotion, like resentment, or something else will slip out of the lid that we've put on so tightly. Some emotions will bubble up so much that they'll eventually explode. But anyway, repression doesn't work either. It also distances us from what's happening in the moment. So if we're tired of acting out, we're tired of repressing, there's a third way that I wanted to talk about tonight. It's kind of bringing the Dharma of mindfulness and meditation to our everyday experience of emotions, and really seeing how we can relate to emotions with the kind of gentleness and attentiveness that we cultivate on the meditation cushion. So there's a three-step process that we can actually develop and work with and bring into play that's somewhere in between acting out and repressing. It's this third option. And the first step goes back to the Tibetan Buddhist yogi, scholar, author, and mystic, Shantideva. And his advice was first to just be like a piece of wood. That the first thing to do when you notice a strong emotional experience coming up is just to freeze. Just tap the brakes, push pause, and insert a little gap before you respond. Remain like a block of wood. This is an aspect of doing no harm. It's that we're not going to harm ourselves, firstly, and we're not going to harm someone else, secondly. And how long we remain like a block of wood really varies depending on the situation. Like going back to our meeting with our boss, we're not going to freeze for like 5 minutes and just sit there. We're not trying to be weird here. But it could just be a second or two as you notice the emotion coming up, and then you continue. And then the second aspect of working with difficult emotions in this way is first we remain like a block of wood, and then we feel. We feel where in the body we're experiencing this emotion. So we know through the interoceptive system that each emotion has a corresponding feeling in the body. So for anxiety, it might feel like a crepe paper chest, you know, thin enough to puncture. For anger, it could be heat rising up the back of your neck in a clenched fists. For for fear could be a tight ball in the pit of your stomach that feels like lead. So whatever it is, we can come to the body in that moment and kind of see with a sense of curiosity what's happening. And what we'll notice when we do that is that these emotional states aren't fixed. They're not frozen and solid. That they actually are fluid and dynamic. And if we don't perpetuate them by telling stories about them, research shows that they'll only last about a minute and a half. These strong experiences of anger, sadness, frustration, they have about a 90-second half-life. That's the amount of time it takes for the chemicals to flood your system, to have the physical response, and then to clear out. So as long as we don't perpetuate that with further storytelling, we can actually get through that by just doing the 90-second thing, which is being like a block of wood, coming to the body and noticing where you feel the emotions. And then the third is we apply the meditation technique of coming back to our anchor of the breath. And just without repressing what we're feeling, without holding on to it, just breathing, being aware of that, and breathe out and let it go. So we're not pushing the feeling away. We're simply breathing. And like thoughts, like we relate with thoughts in meditation, we're acknowledging it and then letting it go. And this seems like a lot, right? It seems like a lot, but I can tell you that it actually is something that can be cultivated in meditation practice. You know, we can bring a sense of gentleness and inquisitiveness and letting go to emotions when they come up in meditation and see how it works. So next time that strong story comes up when you're in practice, you know, instead of either following it and acting it out in your mind and kind of having that conversation, or repressing it and saying, no, I'm just back to the breath, back to the breath, back to the breath. You could try to locate within your body where that feeling is. I actually had a really great chance to practice this today. I've been feeling kind of a sinus thing come on, and I had a pretty nasty infection a couple of months ago, and I'm like nervous about it coming back, so I went to see an acupuncturist. And as I'm there on the acupuncture table, like full of needles in my arms and legs and scalp, there's this fly that keeps landing on me. And it's like, first it's on my leg, and then it's on my arm, and then it was like got really courageous and was even on my face. And I couldn't do anything. And I found myself like spinning out in this story about this fly. Like, I'm in the wrong city, but I'm kind of have a thing about germs. And I'm like, God, this fly is just like vomiting, and it's been in the bathroom. It's just like got bacteria all over it. And like I have these needles on me, and like they're supposed to be sterile, but I don't know if they are anymore. And I can't do anything. Like I'm kind of shaking, but it doesn't go away. And then I just notice, like, oh shit, I'm doing that thing where I'm coming up with stories to fuel what I'm actually feeling, which is fear. You know, fear of this thing that I can't control, fear of the uncontrollable, fear of germs, which is another version of the uncontrollable. And that fear was feeling like a pit in my stomach, like this cold, gnawing, like really tense situation. And so I just did the 90-second thing and came to my breath and just kind of was like, this is my anchor through this situation, and the fly didn't go away. And I was like, well, how do I relate when I feel ticklish and I'm on the meditation cushion? Do I scratch every time I feel a sensation? No, I just sit with it. Can I do that? So I brought some curiosity to it. And the fly didn't go away, but I was able to relate to it in a different way. And sure enough, in less than a minute, that panicking, claustrophobic experience that I was having had changed and turned into something else, which was more of like a minor annoyance. So this is something that can be practiced and is accessible. And what happens is that we're able to better connect with what's really happening in the moment. What's happening with ourselves? What's going on? What are we experiencing? And then we can actually be there for the person in front of us. You know, so instead of getting defensive and protective and trying to hold on to our own territory, we can actually see, well, what's this? What's going on with this person? And have some curiosity and some presence. And they say that by doing this is when wisdom can actually arise. That we'll actually begin to see the way to act in a situation. Rather than doing our habitual thing, wisdom will come up, which basically shows up as intuition, forgiveness, letting go, kindness, gentleness. You know, you can never be too gentle. That's the good news. So it might seem daunting to think about this process, especially around emotions, which have kind of been like, for me, the big thing I had to figure out how to work with. But it is possible. It is possible to change our reaction and change our responses. Neuroscience tells us about neuroplasticity, that we can change the way our mind works and our mind is wired. So through meditation, through applying the technique of coming back to our anchor and back to the breath, and through showing up to the rest of our everyday life with these same principles, we actually might be able to start to see this change. So I think that's about all I had to say from the talk, but I'm happy to open it up for questions and discussion.
I have a quick question about the block of wood.
Yeah.
It's kind of being literal, but when I think of a block of wood, it makes me think of being repressed.
Mm.
So I don't know, does the teacher who talked to you about that, like that's the kind of feeling that I feel with fear or,
yeah,
or repressing feelings.
Yeah.
So when you say that, it kind of makes me...
Okay.
I like everything else sounds really good,
and yeah.
But that, for some reason, just doesn't work
for me. It doesn't work for you.
Is there like something else to be said or that you've said or that the teacher explains about that?
Well, I think another way I've heard that imagery described of is just like a twig or a stick. So rather than a block, you know, this kind of vibrant, alive thing that's just for the moment is just kind of static and still. But I think the key component is an image that reflects doing no harm. You know, just kind of hitting the pause button and interjecting just a little bit of space. That's really the key. So if that image doesn't work for you, maybe something else would.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
The gap that you speak of makes me think of sort of interrupting a karmic cycle. Does this have to do with karma? And if so, could you talk about that a bit?
Yeah. You know, I think that's slightly outside of my expertise within emotions, but I would say that when we're in meditation, we're definitely interrupting karmic flow. We're definitely kind of putting a space when we might otherwise be acting out our karma, like shopping or, you know, buying something, relating in the way that we normally would. And so, you know, in the act and process of meditation, we're kind of interrupting that. So it seems to me that this smaller gap could also be a version of that as well. They were kind of... putting the brakes on our habitual way of doing things, which I think is another way of describing our karmic flow, our karmic path. Great, thanks.
I just want to point to what you mentioned about the stories, and it's kind of funny because I've been developing this self-awareness thing and just realizing, like, one thing I would do, I would actually respect the power of these emotions. And just thinking, well, why am I feeling this? I don't know if that's connected with the Shambhala tradition and just stopping and not just thinking about where exactly the emotion's located, but exactly what's going on here. You know, what is the root of this? Mm. What is the purpose of this emotion that's coming? And just figuring out just the chain of events within the story that you're creating. So... I guess that could be considered somewhat of a strategy of dealing with the frequency of these emotions that come up.
That's right. I like that a lot. And it seems like there's a lot of wisdom in being curious about what's going on. What's the root of this emotion? Where does it come from? I think that, you know, you asked about, does it fit into the Shambhala perspective? And I think yes and no. If we, in the emotional experience, are then putting more words to it and saying, where is this coming from, like right then in the heat of the moment, that might be like a subtle way of repressing what we're feeling or acting it out. So I think the 90-second thing would be a good time just to come to the feeling and then investigate once the feeling has passed. You know, when we talk about wisdom and insight coming up, maybe that comes up in the moment and maybe it comes up directly afterwards. I think that, yeah, just noticing if we're creating further stories about the emotion or if we're kind of coming into insight about where it's coming from. And I think it's just like a subtle thing there. But it sounds great to me. Yeah, thank you.
So I've noticed as I'm meditating more that I'm noticing that gap that I'm able to sort of insert. And although I notice it might, and actually when it will sort of bring me back to my breath and calm me down and make things clearer. And sometimes I find if I'm up against someone else who's got their story going too, it kind of calms them down when I calm down.
Yeah.
But occasionally it doesn't calm them down, you know, and then you are faced with this sort of trying to remain calm while someone else is still in their story. And that can be a challenge.
Yeah.
Any advice?
Yeah. It does sound like a challenging situation for sure. I think calm is often the way to go. I think gentle is a word that I like, and kind, right? Because kind can be multifaceted. Gentleness can be multifaceted. You can have tremendous ferocity with kindness. Your intention is to be kind. But it could be the kindness of a mother pulling their child out from oncoming traffic, right? So for me, if the situation feels like calm isn't the way to go, or the other person, that's just amping them up even more, if I'm able to work with my own emotions, I can better see what the situation needs. And maybe it's calmness, maybe it's something else, maybe something needs to be said, you know, very directly and very clearly. But it's only kind of seeing through the fog of my own emotional response that I'll know what the situation actually needs.
Can I just give an example?
I
was on the street, and there were two homeless people walking towards me, and there was a couple in front of me. And the couple didn't move out of the way. They bumped this homeless woman, and her bag fell, and a bottle broke. And the homeless woman was a little bit upset, but the other woman was very irritated by the fact that she had even encountered this person. And the homeless man turned to the woman and said, "I just want to make sure you're okay." Not the homeless woman, but the other woman.
Wow.
And I mean, really, like, very genuine. He's like, "Ma'am, I just want to make sure you're okay. We just bumped you. Are you okay?" And she just had her story about who these people were. And he really tried to, like, be compassionate with these people. And you could just tell they were too far into their story, you know, and you encounter that every day. And I guess the more you become connected with your own sense of wisdom and compassion, it's easier to deal with that.
Yeah, you start to notice these things, and you start to really care about them. Yeah, I think there's another talk just in that. How do you navigate every life in a city where the more you become present and the more you become aware, the more you notice how many people are just moving through, just locked in their own minds. You know, they're just certainly depressed and certainly going through difficulty and how to relate to that. So thank you for sharing.
Certain emotions will cause me to have very shallow breathing, and that makes the breath an anchor that creates anxiety. So what would you do in that situation?
Yeah. Does it feel like the shallow breathing is the only way you can breathe?
That's the way I breathe when I'm not actively trying to change my breath.
Yeah. I mean, I know in the kind of meditation I led, we talked about not changing your breath, right? Just letting it be in its natural rhythm. But I think that we have this amazing gift with our breathing that it's either an automatic or a manual function, and that we can actually take the reins if we want to. And so one trick I've learned is actually elongating the exhale as a way of resetting the central nervous system when I'm feeling anxiety or fear. So actually like counting in, you know, however many breaths my in-breath is, and then purposefully slowing my out-breath so it's twice as long, and really actively taking the reins. And then, you know how we put our hands on our thighs in meditation? That's actually a grounding technique. And so, you know, if you're really having a strong anxious response, elongating the out-breath, and then touching your lower body, kind of squeezing just above your knees, is a way to bring yourself back into to flush the chemicals, flush the cortisol, and come back to a calm state. Those are both good techniques. And if that doesn't seem like enough, the third aspect could be to imagine yourself in a safe place where you're not feeling anxiety. So it could be this room, it could be your bedroom, or somewhere where you have a sense of safety, and you can actually use your imagination to bring up those thoughts. And again, the body can't differentiate between what's really happening and what we're thinking, so you can kind of trick yourself through that. Does that sound useful?
Yeah, that's useful. Thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome. Well, if there's nothing else, I think there's tea, cookies, fruit, and vegetables outside. And we're all happy to talk more one-on-one. So thank you all so much for spending your Tuesday night with me and with all of us tonight. Yeah, take care.
Thank you, Kevin. Visit our website, ny.shambhala.org, for all of our upcoming courses and weekend retreats. Again, our introductory meditation course, Meditation in Everyday Life, is happening again in October, the four Thursdays in October. Lots of other weekend retreats and course offerings happening as well. Email us at podcast@shambhalanyc.org. Your questions, comments, suggestions, whatever you got. If you live in a different city, there's probably a Shambhala Meditation Center near you. But if you are in the New York City area, come to our weekly Dharma gathering. It's every Tuesday night at 7 o'clock. You can hear these talks live and in person, meet the other meditators, your fellow travelers on the Meditation in the City journey, and keep listening to the podcast. Later.